This is the second of two sessions dealing with Jesus as a political figure. For the sake of those who weren't here yesterday, I spent some time backing over the reasons that that's a question, because major segments of Western Christian thought have tried to see Jesus as non-political or apolitical, concerned with something else than the realm we call political. And then we simply leaf through the gospel story and observe that from one end to the other, what was going on was clearly political agenda. The expectations with which people looked forward to the one who was coming, the language Jesus used when he came out into his public ministry, his temptations, both at the beginning of his ministry and at the end, his vocabulary, his choice of themes for moral instruction. None of those things fit with the notion of an apolitical religious ministry. They all had to do with issues of power and poverty and human relationships and the hope of people to be free. The theme for today is how Jesus found a distinctive answer to how to be a political figure, what kind of political figure he was, and why. So whereas yesterday we were talking more in a narrative way, today we'll talk more about the discursive, that is, the reasons he gives for the kind of position he takes and which he expects his disciples to follow him in. First, I can maybe help by approaching the matter schematically in terms of types. And whenever you use types or models, it's a little unfair to the story, because when people are living, they aren't trying to live up to some type, they're just doing what they want to do. And yet we can see a certain logic in the alternative ways to go about what you're trying to do, and we can use the notion of types or models to clarify the thinking we have to do. There are four identifiable groups in the society of Jesus' time, all of them concerned about the liberation of Jerusalem, or of the Jewish people, and going about those concerns in significantly different ways. Although, historically speaking, those people had their own identity, I propose to use them as type labels rather than simply to read their own story. There were people who were reasonable, moderate, realistic. They were not optimistic about the chances of getting rid of the Romans, but they thought, and rightly, that with proper care, it would be possible to make the best of a bad deal. That is, granted the fact that the Romans won't go away, they will continue to be among us with their tax demands and with their idolatrous emblems and with their soldiers. We can at least negotiate with them so that their presence will be less oppressive. The two groups of people that did this, that happened to get named in the New Testament story, were the people around the temple, which itself was a kind of a political entity because it had its own taxation base and its own properties and its own decision-making structure. These people are usually called the Sadducees, from the name of Zadok, the patriarch of the priestly line. Their organ for administering the temple was the council, or the Sanhedrin. And secondly, it had happened over the years, and was still the case, that one of the instruments that the Romans would use to govern a country was a puppet prince or king, who would theoretically have some degree of independence and therefore would take care for the Romans of the problem of maintaining local order and yet would be completely subject to the Romans. The best example of that, obviously, in our period is Herod and his house. So we find references in the Gospels to the Sadducees and the Herodians. Now, these were not all bad people. They were realistic people who were doing the best they could to save what could be saved of the dignity of their nation. And they were quite successful. They had obtained for the Jews a right that nobody else in the Roman Empire had, to have their own temple coinage without any pictures on it, so that there would be no idolatry involved in paying the temple tax, and they wouldn't use Caesar's coins for that. They even had the concession of the Romans that when the Roman army would come to Jerusalem, they wouldn't bring their flags and their banners and their ensigns along, because those were idolatrous, and they would therefore not spiritually pollute the city of Jerusalem with these idolatrous symbols. And in other ways, they had a degree of self-administration within their acceptance of the Roman presence. Well, that's always one thing to do with an oppressive situation, to make the best of a bad deal. That is, to work within the system to make it not quite so bad, to mitigate its damage. And although there were certainly some scoundrels within the band, and Herod himself was not an especially noble person, there were also very decent people in that structure, conscientious people, honestly doing the best they could for the defense of the rights of their people, in a situation where their rights had to be haggled for because they had no sovereignty. And that's always one of the things you can do when you're concerned about the rights of your people. The extreme alternative was the group briefly mentioned yesterday, the Zealots, the National Liberation Front, the underground rebels waiting for a time to burst out and take over the country. They existed from well before the birth of Jesus and continued to act until the middle of, or the first third of the second century. What they were going to do is obvious. They were going to have a righteous revolution. It would be miraculous because God would help and would send the angels. It would be righteous because it was for a good cause against the enemies of God. It would establish a regime which at the same time would be progressive in that it would be righteous in terms of obeying the law of God, and also in a sense conservative because it would re-establish the temple and the sovereignty which we remember from the age of David. That's obviously always something you can think about doing in a situation of oppression, and the fact that I could use modern analogies like the National Liberation Fronts of Algeria or Vietnam or Mozambique is a specimen of how logically that kind of thing comes to mind. In between, there were two other groups that we find some traces of who also cared about the wrongness of the situation and also cared about the liberation of their people, but went about it in a different way. One group we've learned about just in the last 30 years through a great number of new discoveries of ancient texts. They were communities in the desert. But they didn't go to the desert because they didn't care about Jerusalem. They went there because they did. They knew that the present situation in which the honor of God was being defamed by the presence of pagans and the subservience of their nation was a scandal before God. They must do away with it. But they couldn't do away with it in their own force. Only God could do away with it, and he would do so, most likely, if they were the most righteous that they could be. In order to be that, they went off to the desert where they could maximize their faithfulness to all of the law and ritual bathing and study of scriptures and copying of scriptures, thanks to which we now have better texts of the Old Testament scriptures than we had before, and getting ready for the time when God would act, perhaps through the Zealots, perhaps through something else, perhaps just through a bolt of lightning, in order to clean things up and set them right. So their withdrawal was a withdrawal out of concern, not of unconcern or self-righteousness. The last group that we are more used to hearing talked about was the people who, like the desert saints, withdrew, separated themselves, but they withdrew inwardly rather than outwardly. That is, they stayed in town. They continued with their occupations, but they kept themselves clean. The word for separation, or keeping yourself clean, the root is P-R-S, Pharisee. The Pharisees were the separatists who lived within the society but maintained forms of dramatic separation from what was wrong with the way things were. They were not to touch a Roman coin. They were, in other ways, not to relate to this pagan presence in their midst. Caring as well for liberation, but not doing anything about it because God would do it in his good time, which is incidentally still the conviction of the most Orthodox Jews who disapprove of the present Israeli state because men did it instead of waiting for God to do it. Now, what's Jesus going to do? Which of these logical options will make sense to him? Well, we don't know of any attraction that the Sadducean path might have had on him. He did converse with Nicodemus once, who was from that crowd. He did have a kind of friendships that led Joseph of Arimathea, who was from that crowd, to arrange for his funeral. He might very well have had other contacts that we don't know about, but in any case, there's no indication that that path would have been of any attraction for him. There may have been some connection to the desert communities in the beginning of his ministry, since that's where John was, and John was somewhat that kind of a geographically withdrawn person, but at least there's no indication in the continuation of the text that that option appealed to Jesus. And when the story really becomes a narrative in the gospel, Jesus sets his face toward Jerusalem. That is, he's going to where the people are and where there will be a confrontation. He's closer to the Pharisees, that's why we hear him talking with them more. Our ordinary reading of the gospel story on the surface makes us think the Pharisees were the bad guys, but really they were the best of the people around him. That's why he took them seriously. And his style of arguing with them is the style that you have when you argue with people who are close to you, or you have enough in common that your remaining differences are really important. The Pharisees were, in fact, in a sociological sense, the historians would say that Jesus was a part of the wider Pharisaic movement. He agreed with them about the importance of fulfilling the law, he agreed with them about the resurrection, about the power of God's intervention, about the wrongness of selling out to the occupation. But he differed with them at the point of their way of maintaining their purity and their self-respect. And when the crunch came, they joined with their traditional adversaries, the Sadducees, to get him out of the way. The fourth group that I mentioned was very different from the others in the attraction it had for him. Jesus had many zealots in his audience. He had zealots among the 12. He also had other kinds of people, of course. If Matthew was a tax collector, that was from all the other side of the spectrum, so he didn't have only zealots. But there seems to have been a proportionate preponderance of zealots in his audience and in the narrower circle of his disciples, because he talked their language. He was against what they were against. He seemed to share their vision for God's intervention to make the world right. And yet, in the last analysis, he wasn't a zealot after all. And our main assignment to the end of this hour will be to clarify why that was so clear in his mind, when it wasn't in theirs. There is a fifth option. Jesus finds a way that is no one of those four. And here again, to speak schematically, each of these four ways was a way to assume that the total course of history, or the total course of Jewish national history, was to be looked at as a whole and manage from the top. So if you want to be in charge of it conservatively, you get in the present structure, the Sanhedrin. If you want to take charge of it critically, you have a revolution and knock it down and take it over. Even the people who withdrew to Qumran were waiting for God to intervene at the center with a reestablishment of righteousness for the whole people. That is, each of these strategies was a way to take charge or to see oneself or one's movement as in charge of the course of history. The fifth option differs at that point. It sees two histories or more. It sees the wider history of the established community, the world, or also on a smaller scale, the nation. And then it sees a different community with a different history, another society, interlocking with the first, but not completely dependent upon it. Now, Jesus didn't invent that. He simply renewed it. It was there in his scriptures. Abraham, who had left the center of culture in the Mesopotamian basin to go off and be a nomad. Joseph, who by his wisdom had saved the Egyptian empire from economic collapse, but who didn't merge his people into its culture. Moses, who again took his people out from the dominant society of the time. David set up a kingship, a kingdom, but it didn't last very long. It didn't work very well. The one half of it, which split off just a generation after David's death, didn't last long at all, and the other lasted another century. But by the time we get to the prophet Jeremiah, he says God's given up on that kind of statehood. He wants you to live in dispersion, not be a nation like the others. A constant tension in Old Testament experience was whether to be a nation like the others. And the call of Abraham, the call of the prophets, was always, don't be a nation like the others. And that's what Jesus renews. He creates a people, a group, a community, that's not like the other nations. That is, that's not run from the top by a king, but is different in many of its structural characteristics, and these structural characteristics are all what we call political. Any society has a way of dealing with offenders by some kind of punishment, and if it's real nice, rehabilitation. Jesus gives people a different thing to do with offenders. You forgive them because God has forgiven you. He even put in the model prayer, forgive us as we forgive. Any political structure has a way of making decisions, usually by assigning power to somebody at the top, who may share it to some degree or not through processes of consultation or in the modern world, democracy. Jesus gives his people a way of making decisions by conversation and consensus under the leading of the Holy Spirit. Every society, every political entity has some way of stratifying people, that is, of discriminating between the ones on top and the ones on the bottom. You need that structure in order for a political entity to stay together, so that you have the most obvious samples are the slave or the servant under a master, children under their parents, slaves under their masters, no, women under men. Those are the standard patterns of classification, and Jesus sets up a society in which those things change through the affirmation of the equal dignity. We'll go greater into the differences that made. It started already in his earthly ministry, and it runs on into the later church. Every political entity has some way of dealing with money, generally in providing for some people to have more of it than others and for them to make the decisions. Jesus sets up a community which deals with money otherwise, by sharing it. Every political unity does something about tribal identity. That is, it has outsiders. And it defines who's an insider on the basis of criteria that aren't really open to be shared. As they're biological or ethnic, or you have to have come over in the Mayflower, or you have to have had German-speaking grandparents, or whatever it takes. The definition of what it takes really to be in a community have always deal somehow with tribal definitions. Jesus creates a community to which everybody belongs, which is cosmopolitan in its vision, although it'll take a generation and the story of the book of Acts to make that become clear. He laid the foundations for that. Every political entity deals with the issue of power in its extreme form of violence and the capacity to kill. Most political units restrict this authority to kill to a few people. In fact, for some people, that's really the definition of a state. It's an entity that can control the authorization to kill. Jesus sets up a society in which there'll be no violence. We could look at other samples, but these are relevant enough and fundamental enough. This is what politics is made of. And on these questions, Jesus sets up a community that deals differently. So that's the kind of political figure Jesus was. He was the creator or the re-creator of an alternative political entity. Now our word for that, the word that he used got translated into Greek, which we translate into church. So we think that means a religious organization. But the word he used in Aramaic and even the Greek word ekklesia were not religious words. They were political words. Ekklesia meant town hall, the gathering, the assembly, the parliament. It's where people come together to do business. That's the word that we translate church. But he meant it, the community come together to do business. That's what he created. Now that didn't liberate Palestine right away the way the Zealots wanted to do. Neither did it destroy Palestine the way the Zealots did once they got control and provoked the Romans into a lethal backlash. But it did start a new story going in the world, which was God's answer to the question of what do we do about the call for liberation. And now to shift, but I ought to stop here for questions of clarification and to repeat the request that if there's anything that isn't clear along the way, it's up to you to wave or shout or something to get clarification. Then I propose to go on to the thought content behind this. How was it that it made sense for Jesus to take this other way? But let's stop first to ask whether there's a need for clarification about what's been said so far.
Did all the Jews, all the devout type Jews, belong to one of those divisions of Judaism? Were they all either Pharisees or Sadducees or?
Well, anybody who took some kind of a position had these options. There, of course, were people who were just trying to make ends meet and didn't have time to be devout, or if they were about devout, didn't have time to hassle.
Like Mary and Joseph, for instance, would they have naturally been, you know, part of a group just by being from, you know, like we become Lutherans or that? Would they just have been, you know, by birth, part of a group like that, or do you have to be dedicated to something and make an effort to get into one of those groups?
Well, there's one category of people that very clearly didn't belong. That's the kind that they could just call the country folk. And they just didn't have the time or the energy. They were just so busy making a living that they couldn't keep the rules that the Pharisees set up, for instance, and they couldn't get to Jerusalem to help in the Sanhedrin process. And so there were non-committed people. Now, it's a challenge when you ask about Mary and Joseph, because I don't think we have any indication of any prior division there, that is, of their taking sides. We know they were devout people because they made the pilgrimage to Jerusalem, the story of Jesus, the 12-year-old, and that they were law-abiding because they made the pilgrimage to Bethlehem to pay taxes or for the registration for taxation. But I'm afraid we have to check with New Testament scholars that know more whether there's any grounds for thinking what kind of bias they might have had within the Jewish culture. Very good question.
This idea of the ekklesia being the place where we do business is a new idea to me. Was that used in the political sphere, or where they?
In the ordinary secular Greek, this was town meeting. Town choir goes around and says, "We're going to make a decision about taxation for next year. We're going to whatever they did in a town meeting," and people would come out. They're called out. That's what the word means. People come out when the town choir calls. And that existed in ordinary lay Greek long before the Christians took it over. and even the New Testament usage very seldom is talking about a liturgical gathering. It's usually talking about the whole body of people as gathered, whatever they do together.
So there would have been a lot of ecclesia, depending on what your interests were?
Well, society wasn't very subdivided, but every town would have its ecclesia. Every town would have its deliberative body. I would suppose they could have used the term to describe to other voluntary groups that would have meetings, but it's usually a little more formal than that. It's something public. It meets out there in the square. This whole village could have its ecclesia if people come together because their being together is a part of what God wants them to do together and be functional some way. Not just an audience, but a body for action.
What was the name of this withdrawn community, the desert?
Sometimes they call them the desert communities, the desert sects. Sometimes they're called by the name of the cave in which the first manuscripts were found, Qumran, Q-U-M, capital R-A-N. Sometimes the earlier term was used that may have applied to some of them, Essenes, E-S-S-E-N-E-S. They're named by that name in the old historian Josephus.
Was John the Baptist one of these?
It's suspected he had some connections with them, although his big preaching ministry that gathered in a lot of other people, that wouldn't have been typical of them. But his lifestyle was like theirs, very rigorous, and his living out there, and his condemning everything. So that fit with, at least he came from that direction.
On these Essenes or Qumran, you mentioned that they went into the desert because they thought they could help Jerusalem in their own way by becoming pure, if I understand correctly. I still don't, in my own mind, see how that could really help Jerusalem.
Well, it's because God is sovereign, and we just have to get him to act. We can't act. We're too weak.
So it was a part of
prayer. God will act if we're faithful. God is waiting to act until we're faithful. God does not act because he's chastising us for our unfaithfulness. We're not keeping the rules well enough. And the way down through later Jewish history, the idea always was around that if ever one Jew would completely keep the rules, God would set up his kingdom.
In other words, it didn't have to be the whole.
We don't do it, no. That is, we don't set up the kingdom. We obey, and if God sees this obedience, then he'll be ready to intervene, and he'll clean it up.
Would that be comparable to like a monastery kind of life?
Well, their life couldn't be very well compared to a monastery in that it's separate and it has a very firm discipline. But monasteries the Christian monasteries, most of them are not operating under the assumption that their faithfulness is going to make God intervene in a special way. They do think their prayers relate to the welfare of the rest of the church, but they wouldn't have the same sense of the drama of looking forward to cataclysm.
You were gentler with an approach which is almost without exception the Lutheran approach than you were in your book Original Revolution. Just so people know that the Lutheran approach is seriously challenged by the last 20 minutes, I'll say how I feel the challenge. In reading the four options, and I read them in the Original Revolution, and the Herodian one was the last one. And I finally found me. It was chaplain to the institution. I was the director of a Lutheran social service agency. It was making the best of a bad situation. It was taking people who were crunched by a welfare system and at least seeing that they didn't starve. It was chaplain to the military, an institution that we do not want, but if there is one, let's take care of the spiritual welfare of the Lutherans who have to be there. And the last line in John's summary was, of all four options, this one tempted Jesus the least. First, I just put the book down and decided I wasn't going to read that anymore. But in wrestling with that, I think it really is a challenge. One of the reasons I left social service work. So it was a dangerous book for me. And I hope that the conversation will continue because I think it's a legitimate challenge to something that we are fairly comfortable with, that we have found the option. the challenge as I hear it is Jesus did not like that option very well, and we want to be faithful to Jesus. It's all right. you don't have to be gentle with us, because this group will ask you or fight back. And so far, no one seemed to pick up that kind of...
Well, I'm not sure it's a specifically Lutheran temptation. It has Calvinist forms and Catholic forms, yeah, and Mennonite forms and Quaker forms as well. So we're all with it in our time. But I think it is fair to say that Christianity, since the Middle Ages, has generally taken this slant. Except that since the Middle Ages it's different, because now you can't blame it on Caesar that you can't get something better.
Feeding the 5,000 and healing the lame, that's somewhat along the same line, isn't it? I mean, if you're making the best of that situation.
Yeah, but he was dramatizing much more than an ordinary dole would do, that this is a new world, and that I'm starting something brand new, and that I'm somebody brand new. It was much more than a soup kitchen. It was a new world in its symbolic meaning. It had the effect, of course, of letting those couple thousand people live a little better for the time being. So he didn't smash the system. It's the zealots that wanted to smash the system. His fifth option doesn't smash the system, it just infiltrates it. But now, back to something more discursive. Why does it make sense to take this fifth position rather than one of the other four? What is the newness? What is the background? What is the explanation which leads us to find it fitting that Jesus should have been who he was? And here we have to turn from the narrative material in the New Testament to the discursive. And in the Gospels, that means that the most intensive and extensive statement we have in one place is the Sermon on the Mount, Matthew 5 through 7. I don't plan at all to do an interpretation of the text, although I've suggested to Walter that we might have a book reading in that area next week. But here we have gathered together in one teaching document, which the scholars think was probably a kind of catechism in the early church, a statement of the newness of the view of things that Jesus has brought. And what is that newness? I'll have to be very sketchy here to try to zip over a little of everything rather than making any points very well. The first thing that is structurally necessary to have a Sermon on the Mount is to have people coming up to Jesus on the Mount. That is, it didn't start with this. This is chapter 5. And in chapter 4, Jesus had begun his public ministry and proclaimed, "This is a new age. The kingdom of God is at hand. Repent and accept the good news." Those are the same words that John had used before. And they're the same words he's going to send his disciples out to use later. But now he uses them. That means this is a time when old models don't reach. We don't assume the adequacy of experience or realism or our knowledge of the system. God is now doing something, beginning to do something, that will establish his sovereignty in a new way. That means we don't reason anymore within the limits of the possibilities of the past. We don't think of our involvement in history as a closed system where there are only so many options. A power is coming, the power of God as king, that is now going to be active in our midst in a way that wasn't the case before. And there are people who gather to respond to that. Jesus withdraws to the mountain. The scholars think this is kind of symbolically related to Moses going to the mountain for the old law. The disciples come to him. That is, it isn't the crowds this time. People come to him to hear, and now he says, this is the way it is. So the literary structure that leads us up to the Sermon on the Mount, it dramatizes its newness and its authority as a kind of charter for Christian discipleship. The first segment is a series of brief texts that we call the Beatitudes, which we often understand, I think, wrongly. How have you understood the Beatitudes? Blessed are the meek, for they shall inherit the earth. Now, what do you do with that? I think generally, we have been trained by our culture to see this as a kind of exchange, I be meek and then God will reward me. I perform and my performance will be blessed. So blessed means rewarded. That is, we're being shown a good kind of thing to be doing, and it would be good for you if you would do those things, because then God would reward you. Now there's some problems with that. Obviously, how does this relate to the wider Christian understanding of grace and justification not being by our works? There are also linguistic problems, because the word that is used, translated blessed, doesn't really mean going to be rewarded. It means almost lucky or privileged. Another difficulty with this idea that the Sermon on the Mount is a set of moral imperatives that we are to fulfill in order to be blessed is that some of them are things you can't fulfill. How do you go about mourning? You can't just up and mourn. Mourning is something that happens to people often because of a sickness or a catastrophe or something that wasn't in their control. And even being hungry and thirsty for righteousness is not really something that you can just decide I'm going to do one day. These are descriptions of the status of a certain category of people, a category of people for whom in the past it was not well. They were not lucky. And this category of people now will be in, because the kingdom is coming. So the Beatitudes are simply the tail end of the kingdom proclamation. The kingdom is here, so it's going to be good for the people for whom it was bad before. There are people who are mourning. Good for them, because now they'll be in, consoled. There are people who want justice. Good for them, because they'll get it. There are people who are by nature peacemakers. Good for them. Now it will be visible that God is like that. So it's the proclamation of the nature of the kingdom as fitting the people who were of such character that now they're in, when before they were out. The kingdom is that new. So it's a privilege. It's a description of the privilege of people who previously were not privileged, rather than it is a statement of imperatives or norms or duties or virtues that we should try real hard to live up to, and then God would bless us in the sense of reward. The blessing is rather the privilege of being in on this new thing, which happens to be for the last and the least, rather than for the ones who were in power. That is, the kingdom is often described in Jesus' teaching as a matter of the last being first and the first last. Well, then, if you're last, good for you. That's what the Beatitudes mean. You were the last, good for you, because now the kingdom is coming, and the last will be first. Another observation comes next in the imagery, is that these people that follow Jesus are going to be visible. A city on a hill, a candlestick lighting a dark room, or slightly similar image, but not about light, salt giving flavor to the whole soup. As your presence reaches beyond yourself to give some service, some light, some taste, some quality to the whole human community. So Jesus places the behavior of these people in the context of witness. He doesn't simply say, what I'm going to tell you about right and wrong is information about duties and prohibitions, and you better learn them so you can do it right. He says, your doing this rightness, your being this new people, is going to be a proclamation. It's going to be visible. Proclamation is not simply something a preacher says from the pulpit. Proclamation is something we be. John has referred, as I hadn't thought I would, to a particular Lutheran agenda, as identity as an agenda. One of the striking pioneer efforts in recent German Lutheran New Testament studies in the last 20 years is an effort to relate social ethics to proclamation, since it's hard to get some Lutherans to talk about ethics because they're afraid of earning anything through their goodness, and justification by works is a bad thing. Why not talk to Lutherans about ethics as proclamation? That is, what does it say to the world that we act the way we do? If I feed the hungry, what does that say to the world about the gospel? If I love my enemy, what does that say to my enemy about who God is? So ethics is proclamation. and that's what Jesus here says, you're going to be the kind of people whose visibility will lead men and women to glorify your Father. So your action is seen as preaching, not simply as doing or not doing good and bad deeds, but as communicating something about the nature of the grace of God. Then as we move into the bulk of the first chapter of the Sermon on the Mount, we find six specimens of contrast between what you have heard people say and what I say. Jesus prefaces this by saying, I have not come to do away with the law, but to fulfill it. So these are six ways in which the law is fulfilled. Jesus does not set the law aside, but he does something more with it than it did before. If we had the time, we could look at some depth at the six cases. They're not all parallel in the way the law is fulfilled. Sometimes it's interiorized. You used to know you shouldn't kill. Now I tell you, you shouldn't even hate. It's the same point, but it's made much more deeper internally. Other times it's made more rigorous externally. You used to know that you should love your neighbor, but you could get away with thinking your neighbor is just somebody close. And now I say, no, that means loving anybody, including the enemy. The enemy is also your neighbor. Maybe it needs to be said, because this is a one language community, that in most languages in the world, there are two words for neighbor. We only have one. And we therefore miss something that's very clear in other modern languages and in the biblical languages. One word for neighbor, in German it's der Nächste, equivalents in other modern languages, is the person you have to do with, whoever that is. And if you're dropping a bomb on a Vietnamese village, it's the Vietnamese, because they're the people you're dealing with right then. The other meaning for neighbor is person next door, the Nachbar in German. Those are two different concepts. We get them mixed up, and so did the ancient Jews, and thinking that when you love your neighbor, that's only the people close to you, the people of your social unit, the people of your nation. Jesus says, no, you love your neighbor, but that really means everybody. In fact, the test of whether you really love your neighbor is whether you love all your neighbors, and therefore the enemy is the real test of whether you love your neighbor. There are other ways in which other elements of this intensification of the sermon of the law of the Old Testament takes place, but in general that whole thing applies. Jesus makes the law stronger, the same law pointing the same direction, but he takes it farther, sometimes in inwardness, sometimes in outward breadth of application. In the case of divorce, by withdrawing a loophole that the Old Testament had permitted, he intensifies the meaning of the law. So that's one of the guides for ethics that enable him to come out where he does. Chapter 6 of Matthew, we noticed yesterday that the two best specimens of the ethical problem or the political problem are money and violence. Chapter 5 had dealt with violence and the enemy. Chapter 6 deals with money, with the major part of the chapter being on the matter of trusting God for the future. So that's a new element of the picture, trust. I don't have to take care of my future by saving my money, by taking it away from other needs and ministries today, because God will take care of my future. If I don't think he can do that, then I don't think he's God. That's the message of Matthew 6, the largest portion of the chapter. There are, of course, other pieces along the way all the time, but let me leap to just two other elements of explanation. Now back to Luke. Beyond the Sermon on the Mount, Luke also has something like the Sermon on the Mount, except it's not on a mountain, chapter 6. But moving beyond that, chapter 14 is a very dramatic part of Luke's Gospel. Here Jesus is followed by a crowd. He's popular. He is still popular. Although he's already begun his pilgrimage to Jerusalem, he's begun to see opposition, but he's still very popular. There are still crowds, which means there are still zealot expectations in the crowd. 14:25. And he says to them, if anyone comes to me and does not hate father, mother, wife, children, brothers, sisters, even his own life, he cannot be my disciple. Whoever does not bear his cross and come after me cannot be my disciple. So a radical warning. I don't want a movement whose members don't know what it's going to cost them. And he dramatizes that by telling two stories. These are not strictly parables, but they have a similar kind of impact. They differ from the parables also, apparently, in the fact that that they were relevant to the immediate experience of these people. Who, desiring to build a tower, does not first count the cost whether he can complete it, otherwise when he's laid a foundation and can't finish it, all who see it begin to mock him, saying, this man began to build and was not able to finish. Herod had just done that. This is a political joke. This was as if in the middle of a crowd you would think of the latest federal boondoggle and apply that to the particular case of warning people not to follow you if they didn't know what it was going to cost. And secondly, the reference to somebody who started a war and really hadn't calculated realistically that he couldn't possibly win it. Herod had also just done that. So this is relevant political humor in the service of the warning not to follow Jesus unless you know it'll cost everything. And the next little observation before I go on is a little wobbly from the point of view of strict scholarship. But if we take the story the way Luke tells it, Jesus tells these people that they're going to have to bear a cross. Well, what does a cross mean to these people? He hasn't had his cross yet. They say, well, Luke wrote this up differently after the fact. That would kind of get him off the hook. But even then, why would he have Jesus telling people before his cross that they're going to have a cross? What does the word cross possibly mean? Then, before his cross. Before his cross, it can only mean the cross in general, which was the specific punishment with which the Romans punished only insurrectionists, only zealots. They didn't punish bandits that way, and they didn't punish other kinds of crimes, but crimes against the Roman presence, the crimes of the zealots, were punished by crucifixion. So Jesus' audience is being told in his earthly ministry, before his cross, if you want to follow me, you have to be ready to be seen as a rebel. You have to take on yourself the cost of being seen as a threat to the society and to its powers. Now I say that's something that some scholars would challenge, because they just say that Luke stuck the cross in there. Jesus didn't say that. But it's still significant that Luke has Jesus saying that. And now the deepest statement of all, and with this we'll have to stop the explanation texts. This is in the upper room in Luke's account. In Matthew and Mark we have something very parallel, but it comes earlier. Then it is Mrs. Zebedee who comes to Jesus and wants the authorization to make a request. This is in Near Eastern culture, it's still the case that if some communication is very important, you have a third person go and make it, even if it's with some good friend of yours. If you have somebody else communicate for you, that's because it's important. So James and John didn't go to Jesus themselves, they had Mama do it. And what she wants is that when Jesus takes over, she wants one of her sons to be prime minister and the other minister of the interior. You know, that's literally what it meant. The one that sits at the right hand of the king is the premier, or the viceroy, the person who actually runs the government for the king. One of her sons would be that, and the other would be the next thing, whether it's Ministry of the Interior or Ministry of Defense, depends on which has the larger budget in your particular cabinet. But in Luke's Gospel, we have an almost parallel text, but it comes in the upper room, and therefore nobody comes to Jesus and asks. He just sees. And this is the first thing after the Lord's Supper story. A dispute arose among them, which of them was to be regarded as the greatest. Now that isn't the question of which had the best personality or the best physique or the best intelligence, which was the best guy. It was who was going to have the most power in the coming regime. That means that the night before the crucifixion, hours before Jesus was going to be taken away from them, these people were still zealots. They still had the expectation of a violent takeover for God, in which Jesus was going to lead, and they were going to be his chief lieutenants. After the Lord's Supper, after the celebration already of the meaning of his sacrifice, he says, the kings of the Gentiles exercise lordship over them. Those in authority over them are called benefactors. He agrees with them, that's the way it is in this world. There is the phenomenon of sovereignty. And he doesn't say he's going to do away with it. He's not an anarchist of the type that says we won't have that anymore. Neither is he a divine right theorist who says that's a good thing. He doesn't say it's a good thing. He just says it is. Modern language, we call him a positivist. You just say that's the way it is. Those in authority over them let themselves be called benefactors. In the Greek language, there's a peculiar kind of thing between the adjective and the passive. They let themselves be called benefactors. He doesn't say they are benefactors, but they claim to be. The claim is made for every king. It can be the pettiest Caribbean dictator like Duvalier to the most powerful mover of things in the Kremlin or in Peking or in Washington. The king always says it's for our good. It's always a benefactor. That's the claim that's made for the civil order, always. I'm lord, every lord says, for your welfare. That's a general statement of political science, Jesus makes, but not so with you, because I'm not that way. It's that simple. I'm a servant and not a lord. So you are to be servants and not lords. So we can't take the zealot path, because the zealot path, however polar it is over against the Roman presence, it's still like the Romans in that it believes you can be benefactors by being lords. It wants to meet the Romans in their own terms, play with the Romans their own game. And that's not what I'm here for. Now, we could talk more about why it made sense. That still isn't quite enough to make sense, really, of alternative posture in the world. There would be more of his teaching. There would be the end of Pentecost. There would be the story of Acts in which the Gentiles are gathered in. There would be the vision of the book of Revelation, where it's the Lamb that was slain that is worthy to receive power. There would be deep meditation on the meaning of the resurrection, which says after Jesus' ministry, what his proclamation of the kingdom said at the beginning, that there are new powers available, the world is not a closed system, that when you think there are only these two options and both of them are bad, there might be a third or a sixth, so that we never are boxed into a despairing situation. But all I can try to say with this limited time is that we have here a total new view of the context in which we are to go about being God's people. People not simply as the plural of persons, as we use it in American English, but people in the singular, a group, a nation, God's gathering, God's human unity, God's community. And that community has a whole different set of pictures of what it means to be human. They aren't simply a different political entity, as the fifth way, the community infiltrating the world in its oppressiveness, but they are living out a new vision. They're living out a new theology, a new spirituality. And they're different in politics because they're different in their prayer and different in their view of God and different in their view of history. It's a total new perception of where the world is going, for the sake of which we therefore are in politics, in the different way of which the cross is the firmest specimen. And the cross, as we saw yesterday, was clearly a political event. It was something that the Romans did to somebody they accused of being the king of the Jews. Again, there weren't many interruptions for clarification, and now our time is gone. One or two questions or comments, maybe? Somebody is brief?
With the man hanging on the other two crosses and Jesus was crucified, were they political insurrection?
The scholars debate about this because the old translation is, of course, thief. But the word that Luke uses is translated in other kinds of literature or other kinds of dictionary perspectives as brigand, which is kind of in between, or even as insurrections. So it can be, at least. That word is used in other literature of the time for zealots.
Is it possible for Jimmy Carter to witness to the gospel in the White House?
That's not a succinct question.
Well, he got down on his knees when he made the decision about the neutron bomb.
Yeah, did that make it good?
did that make it a good decision?
Yeah. I think all I could try to say here would be that the way to answer the question of whether anybody in public office is following Jesus is to ask whether this newness shows. Whether it's different from the other ways other people make their decisions or from the content of their decisions. So we just have to look at chapter and verse of how this person claims his faith makes a difference. That he claims to be pious, or that he goes to church, or that he has thought through certain questions of Christian ethics, or that he's read Reinhold Niebuhr, who has a good statement of the reasons for not following Jesus. That doesn't prove anything. I think we just have to look at cases. I wouldn't say a priori nobody in what we call politics could do anything faithful as a Christian. But neither can I say a priori that just as soon as somebody whom we look on as a well-meaning person or a good guy gets in office, then what he does must be all right. And that's our temptation in our culture. There's a little of that, I think, would come up in Damar's theme, which is if you accept what Jesus said here in this core passage, I can't be a lord. I won't run history. I won't run the world. Well, then what can we do? Well, that's the topic for tomorrow.